It's the Veterans Radio Hour. Brought to you by Dallas Corporation for all your corporate printing needs. And by GIM Productions, creating internet solutions. Websites can do that. Now, stay tuned. The Veterans Radio Hour is next on the Veterans Radio Network.
Tango Charlie Bravo, you're a go for the Veterans Hour.
Welcome, one and all, to the Veterans Radio Hour. It's our tribute to all of those who served our great nation's armed forces, past and present, and their tremendous accounts of heroic duty and bravery. With your host, Brigadier General Dave Grange. And now, coming to you live from our Veterans Center studio, here is General Dave.
All right, welcome to the Veterans Radio Hour. This is Kenny DeCamp again sitting in for General Dave due to the Iraqi war. He is sitting over at, I believe, CLTV right now, talking with Aaron Brown on CNN, putting it all together for them to understand a little bit more. But tonight, we've got a very unique show. We're talking about generals as leaders, and I'm sitting with some very important people who understand what leadership is. And probably what the knowledge of being a general is truly all about. Our special guest that I'm really happy that's sitting next to me is Carlo Dieste. He's a retired Army colonel, but he's best known for his books. He's written some beauties. You've probably have seen part of one of his biographies on A&E in relationship to Patton, A Genius for War. He also wrote Eisenhower, A Soldier's Life, among many others, but these are primarily the books we'll be talking about. Carlo, I'm glad you're here with us today.
Thank you and good evening.
Very good. And also with us is James Pritzker, President and CEO of Tawani Enterprises. He also founded and runs the Pritzker Military Library right here in Chicago, Illinois. We're proud that you're with us tonight, James.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Okay, and Dr. John has come by from the Cantini Foundation, our good buddy, the executive director out there. Thanks, John, for coming with us.
Here I am, two shows in a row.
Yeah, and we're happy. It has, I think, a little bit to do with Carlo, and also we found out we've got a real special guest on the line from Argentina. He's Bill Griffin. He is quite the man, W.E.B. Griffin. He is down in Argentina. You there with us in Argentina?
I'm here.
Oh, good. Glad you're here with us. This is a man who, when I looked at his website, I became so impressed just because he's living the life that I like. Argentina, a smile, glass of wine, and a cigar in his hand. He is one happy, good guy. But he's best known for more than 30 epic novels that he's written. And we're going to be talking a little bit more about all of those. Somebody told me he is the novelist of the Marines. And I said, well, probably Army, Navy, Air Force, a little bit of everything. He's quite the unique man. If you want to call in, please, 866-928-2329. Tonight's show, as we talked a little bit about with Dr. John last week, we had a little reminiscing about a very famous man who recently passed away this year, and we're dedicating that show to him because Carlo Dieste said that'd be a good man to dedicate it to, and that's Bill Mauldin, who passed away January 22, 2003, at the age of 81 in Newport Beach, California. Bill Mauldin was noted for his cartoon depictions, his weary World War II soldiers named Willie and Joe. Mauldin had enlisted in the U.S. Army in 1940, was a rifleman for the 180th Infantry. Born near Santa Fe, New Mexico, but everyone, he attended the Academy of Fine Arts in Chicago, Illinois. At age of 23, he won his first Pulitzer Prize for his series Up Front with Mauldin. His second Pulitzer came when he was 59, and he was a cartoonist for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Then he switched to the Chicago Sun-Times. He wrote and drew 16 books and acted in two different movies. One of the movies, which I didn't know, was with John Huston, The Red Badge of Courage. He also starred in World War II with the decorated hero, Audie Murphy.
You're listening to the Veterans Hour with retired Brigadier General Dave Grange. And now, back to the broadcast.
Again, unfortunately, General Dave couldn't be with us. If he gets off early from CNN assignment he's on, he's going to be coming by, and we're sure hoping he does. But let's start out. Let's talk about, I guess Patton would be our first one. Patton, A Genius of War.
Well, I've been very fortunate that I've been able to write about some of the most famous officers who ever served in the U.S. Army. I did a biography of Patton that appeared in 95. And then I thought I would continue on by doing a biography of Eisenhower, which came out last year. But Patton was unique, and I felt that his story was something that should be shared with the world. There'd been quite a bit written about him, but most of it was about World War II, and a lot of it was a little bit far out there. So I undertook what amounted to about a five-year odyssey in trying to chronicle the life of this rather unique man. And it was a challenge, but it was something that I felt was worth doing because, you know, I wanted to get behind the man, the mask. I mean, what you saw in public with Patton, this crude, rather swaggering image of a general was not the real Patton. It was an image that he created for himself and that continued throughout his life. The image was such that eventually even he couldn't tell, you know, what was an act and what was the real thing. But behind that mask was a consummate professional soldier, a man who spent literally his entire life studying military history, studying about war, preparing himself for what he believed as early as 1919 at the end of World War I would be a future role for himself and what he believed would be a second world war. As a matter of fact, he told Eisenhower after they first met in 1919 that he said, "Ike, you know, within 20 years," he said, "there will be another world war." And he was pretty darn close in his estimation. But he was, as I've said, a consummate professional, a man who studied throughout his career, and that's what you didn't see. You saw this public image that he had created, the profane man. And behind that was a guy who became a soldier the hard way.
Uh-huh. And hard way was something that ended up being what he was noted for, being a hard general, I would believe.
Well, that was only part of it. He believed that was part of the discipline of being a general.
Exactly. We'll be right back after this quick message, and we'll be moving in with a little bit of W.E.B. Griffin for a minute.
Stay tuned. The Veterans Radio Show will continue on the Veterans Radio Network.
You're listening to the Veterans Radio Hour. Veterans Radio Hour comes to you every Sunday evening between 8 and 10 p.m. Central Standard Time. We are now a two-hour program. As many of our listeners, regular listeners, know, we were formerly on the air for 1 hour, but we've come up in the world and we're here for 2 hours now, so as I've been saying, if you enjoy the one-hour version, I think you'll like the two-hour show twice as much. Tonight's program is the 30th in our series. It is March 30th, 2003, and the program this evening is dedicated to the subject of generals as leaders, with a focus on Generals Patton and Eisenhower. We're fortunate to have in the studio with us this evening Carlo Desti, noted author of Patton, A Genius for War, which was the basis for the A&E biography program by the same name. He's also the author of many other excellent books. Also a guest this evening is W.E.B. Griffin, who's with us on a phone hookup from Argentina. Mr. Griffin is author of also many well-known books, including Brotherhood of War, Badge of Honor, The Corps, and Honor Bound series. Also, we have Philip Taubman, who will be joining us later in the show. Mr. Taubman is the deputy editorial page editor of the New York Times. He's written about national security and intelligence issues for more than 20 years. In the studio with us also is Mr. James Pritzker. Mr. Pritzker is president and CFO of Tuwani Enterprises. He's founder of the Pritzker Military Library here in Chicago, and is a benefactor and member of the Colby Symposium. John Votaw is back with us this week of the Cantini Foundation. He was participating in the program last week, and we're happy to have him here again. So stay with us here on the Veterans Radio Hour.
Hey,
The Veterans Radio Show is clear for a landing. Let's resume our broadcast from the Veterans Center Studio. The Veterans Hour proudly presents our military hero's story of valor.
Welcome back. This is Kenny DeCamp sitting in for General Dave. Tonight's story of valor goes back to 1944. Technician 5th Class James Ogubu distinguished himself by extraordinary heroism on 28th and 29th of October and the 4th of November 1944 in the Forêt d'Aumalier de Champs near Bifontaine, eastern France. On the 28th of October, under strong enemy fire, coming from behind minefields and roadblocks, technician 5th grade Ogubu, a medic, crawled 150 yards to within 40 yards of the enemy lines. Two grenades were thrown at him while he was, and his facts were being covered in positions to carry back two wounded comrades. Under constant barrages of enemy small arms and machine gun fire, he treated 17 men on the 28th of October, eight more on the 29th of October, and on the 4th of November, 5th grade Ogubu ran 75 yards under grazing machine gun fire, and while exposed to hostile fire directed at him, evacuated and treated a seriously wounded crewman from a burning tank who otherwise would have died. Technician 5th grade James Ogubu was awarded the Medal of Honor.
You're tuned to the Veterans Radio Hour with retired General Dave Grange, coming to you from the Veterans Center Studio. And now, back to the show.
Yeah, I'm sitting here with Carlo D'Este, the great author of Patton, A Genius at War, and Eisenhower, A Soldier's Life, as well as James Pritzker, founder of the Pritzker Military Museum, a retired lieutenant colonel, spent 27 years, I think also a Vietnam veteran. No, not for sure. Oh, I was, so I guess I just took it you were there, too. Anyway, we've got W.E.B. Griffin on the line with us in Argentina. W.E.B. is one of the co-founders of the William Colby Military Writers Symposium, something we'll be talking about a little bit more, that was also co-founded, I believe, by Carlo D'Este.
That's correct.
And also William Colby, of course.
Yes.
And I believe, James Pritzker, you're on the board, a member of the Colby Symposium?
Yes, I am.
Great. W.E.B. Griffin, you're all the way down there. I believe you've written some 30 novels, epic novels. Is that correct?
I'm not sure if they're epics or not, but I've written a lot of books.
Well, I think your website does call them some epics, or at least your publicist did. And and from looking through some of these, I would believe they are the most unique and valued books of our time. Can you tell us, because I see you were in the Army in 46 and 47, and then later again during the Korean crisis in 51 through 53, is that when you began writing?
Yeah, I wrote my first book while I was in Korea, actually.
And that book was?
Comfort Me with Love, actually.
Comfort Me with Love? Were you, like, lonely and sad?
No, it was a story of a soldier. Yeah, that's a long time ago. I couldn't even remember the name for a minute.
But Comfort Me with Love is a good one. What was the most, would you say, your famous novel is that most people would remember?
I really wouldn't be able to answer that. I have no idea.
Well, I would think a lot of people would think Badge of Honor and Brotherhood of War would be two of the most recognized ones.
Well, there's been a lot of books. It's kind of hard to say which is the... You got me on a spot with that question. I don't know how to handle that.
That's okay. Life in Argentina is good for you, I would imagine.
Well, I'm down here working. I've written a number of books about Argentina. And it's a fascinating place.
Yes. On Brotherhood of War, is that one of the novels that does have a series or sequels that run along?
Brotherhood of War is 10 books in that series.
10 different books. And
yeah.
Could you explain to our audience, for people who've never read them or know anything or that much about them, how the 10 series sort of connect together?
Well, they're sequential.
In relationship?
One follows the other. You know?
that's what a good sequel is.
Yeah, they follow each other.
I think I can help you out there a little bit, sir. I've read every one of them, and what it starts out with, Kenny, of course, is they're stories about officers, and it begins with the lieutenants, and it goes through the captains and the majors and the lieutenant colonels and the colonels, and you get all the way up till you get to the generals. It even has several about special operations. And he writes about police, he writes about everything. And the thing that one has to ask is, how in the heck did you ever get so much experience?
I just listen a lot. I just pay attention to people who talk. It's not as hard as it sounds.
Yeah, because the details, as I understand them, of even the books about the Marine Corps are so dead on that all the Marines I've spoken with tell me that your books are the best that they've ever read. Especially
well, that's very
since,
nice to hear that. I hope they're telling the truth. You know?
Well, and you've built that
very flattering. What?
You've built that one on events with you know the China Marines all the way up until the end of the war. And by I just read one by you the other day that was actually about Marines in the Korean War. Same general
that's
characters.
That's what I'm writing now. The second half of that book, really.
Fabulous
from
work.
From Incheon through Ham Hung.
Yeah, and Don Starry says to say hello.
Oh, how good.
I hate to say
one of my favorite people. He's too important for that, but I've got a profound admiration for him.
Well, in the book that had to relate to generals, our theme tonight is trying to figure out, are generals natural leaders? Do they have to end up becoming leaders? And in the book you wrote about generals, what can you tell us in relationship to their leadership?
I don't know. You're talking about Don Starry. When I first met him, he was a young lieutenant, and he didn't look like anything other than any other young lieutenant. And yet he wound up as the man, you know, he designed the Abrams tank. He's the guy that set up the, what, I don't know what they call it now, but the outfit in Tampa, the general, what's his name, running the war over in,
I believe that's
in Iraq is doing. Starry set that up. I have no idea what made him such a brilliant man. He was a very nice lieutenant. I remember that very well when I was a surgeon. And he was obviously smarter than most, but how do you tell him from another general? I have no idea. How could you tell he was going to be a general? I was surprised. It dedicated the Brotherhood to him. I said, whoever thought four stars?
Well, Bill, I think you probably agree with me that one of the reasons he became a general was that you know, he worked hard. He studied, and he had a chance to perform in various roles in war. And I think the cream rose to the top, and I think he's one example.
I worked for General White, and he said, somebody asked him how he got to be a general, and he said, I always did the best I could do whatever job I was given, which sounds pretty noble, except that his distinguished career in armor began as housing officer at Fort Knox, which is not a very glamorous job.
Yeah, Don Starry was...
And then he wound up as he retired as Commander-in-Chief Pacific.
Yeah, Colonel Don Starry was one of the commanders of my regiment, the Black Horse Regiment in Vietnam, and I later worked within his corps when he was the 5th Corps commander in Germany. Mm-hmm. I was still in the Black Horse Regiment then, but he was a little further down the road.
You must know Jim Braden, then.
I do.
And W.E.B., have you also written about any other generals that are of recognition?
No, but, oh, yeah, of course, Bob Williams thinks that he's in my aviation book. Mm-hmm. General Williams is the founder of Army Aviation.
That's right.
He thinks that I wrote about him when I called my character William Roberts.
And
I did, really.
It was him.
Yeah, sure, it was him. Everybody recognized him.
Good. Well, we're moving along. Let's talk a little bit about Patton for a second. If we could, I believe he was dyslexic. Is that what I've once read?
He was. He was a lifelong undiagnosed dyslexic. The evidence of that is pretty well overwhelming. I made a study of dyslexia and what that entailed. And in Patton's case, it was severe. In the sense, particularly when he was at West Point, he failed the first year. He flunked out. It took him 5 years to graduate. He had extreme trouble with his studies. He had trouble with mathematics. He had trouble with foreign language. He had trouble concentrating. One thing that he was blessed with, which is not uncommon at all with people with dyslexia, was that he had a near photographic memory. And he was able to retain things that otherwise he couldn't get when he was trying to study. But he had a brutal time. I think that's probably the best way to describe it at West Point. And so this was something that you know, he carried through his entire life. He also suffered, surprisingly, and people sometimes would have a hard time believing it, but he suffered from low self-esteem, which is a very common phenomenon with anyone with dyslexia. He didn't let it show, but it was there, and it was certainly there during his time at West Point. He really never thought he was going to amount to anything.
It's because one of the people in the chat room, we have a live chat room right now over our web. We're in about 56 countries right now. And somebody asked, they said that they heard that Patton was a major and a lieutenant colonel at many different times. Is that correct?
Well, most of them were, and so was Eisenhower. Patton achieved the rank of colonel during World War I, and Eisenhower rose to the rank of lieutenant colonel. But at the end of the war, there were terrific cutbacks. This army that had been over several million during World War I was cut back to less than 100,000. So most of the regular officers that had held high rank were all busted back. Patton was reduced to captain, and so was Eisenhower. And eventually they got back to major fairly quickly, but then they stalled there for a good part of the interwar years. So at that time, you know, rank came, you know, once every maybe 10 or 12 years.
Some people want to know here in Illinois whether or not Patton went to Fort Sheridan prior to World War II.
Patton did. And matter of fact, his first assignment out of West Point in 1909 was right here at Fort Sheridan, Illinois.
Wow, that's great to have that connection here in Illinois, and we like that a lot. We're going to be talking a little bit more about the Colby Military Writers Symposium in a minute as well, because I'm sure we'll find a lot about what leadership has to do with the writers who write about the leaders. We'll be back to the Veterans Radio Hour right after this commercial message.
In just a moment, the Veterans Radio Show will assemble in a military fashion right after this quick reload on the Veterans Radio Network.
You're listening to the Veterans Radio Hour. Veterans Radio Hour comes to you every Sunday evening at this time. That is 8 to 10 p.m. Central Standard Time. We're heard in some 57 countries here on the Internet, as well as on the Information Radio Network, where you hear us broadcast over the air. We invite you to call in if you have a question for any of our guests or on any of the subjects this evening. The toll-free number is 866-928-2329. That's 866-928-2329. And, of course, don't forget to check out the discussion board here on the website. Email your question, and if it's appropriate, we will flash it out there to our guests at the roundtable, and we'll see if we can answer your question for you. Veterans Radio Hour is sponsored by Dallas Corporation for all your printing needs, by GIM Productions, websites can do that, and by Pabst Blue Ribbon Beer. Pabst Blue Ribbon Beer, as they say, PB Army, ASAP. If you'd like details about sponsoring or becoming a founder of the Veterans Radio Hour, you can reach the business office toll-free at 800-521-0020. If you have a question or comment while the show is in progress, call us toll-free at 866-928-2329. Tonight's show is the 30th in our series. The subject is generals as leaders. The focus is on Generals Patton and Eisenhower, and we're hearing some very interesting information. I thought of a fact that was brought up by Carlo Desti, one of our guests this evening, was quite of interest, which is the fact that General Patton suffered from dyslexia. And as Mr. Desti pointed out, it is common among people who have dyslexia to also have low self-esteem, which I think is somewhat incredible when one thinks of the popular figure of General Patton as we all think of him and as we saw him depicted in the famous motion picture starring George C. Scott. We invite you to listen here every week. All of our previous programs are archived on the website, and you can access them, and you can also hear the first hour of tonight's program on the website starting on Tuesday. It will be broadcast, streamed, I should say, on the Internet around the clock, the first hour of the show. So stay with us here. We'll be going back to our guests in just a few moments on the Veterans Radio Hour.
You're The best in military talk radio now continues with the Veterans Radio Show.
The Veterans Radio Hour salutes the active service person of the week, made possible through the support of Pabst Blue Ribbon Beer. As they say, PBR me, ASAP. Pabst Blue Ribbon Beer, available at your local retail outlet.
Yeah, our active duty guy this week, Corporal Joshua Miles. And he wants me to say, and all the boys from the 3rd Battalion, 2nd Marines, they were in Kuwait. They're on the road right now. But they wrote a poem home, and this is a little piece of it. It said, "Wish you were here. For all the free people that still protest, you're welcome. We protect you, and you are protected by the best. So please stop yelling, put down your signs, and pray for those behind enemy lines. When the conflict is over and all is well, be thankful that we chose to go through hell."
You're listening to the Veterans Hour with retired Brigadier General Dave Grange. And now, back to the broadcast.
Dave Grange is on assignment with CNN, and hopefully we'll be dropping in a few moments to take over this seat. And we're going to continue on with a show we're doing about generals as leaders. We got Carlo Dieste with us. He's the author of some very famous books, but primarily the ones we're talking about, Patton, A Genius at War, and Eisenhower, A Soldier's Life. Also with us on the phone, far away in Argentina, W.E.B. Griffin. He's that man that's written a lot of great books, including The Brotherhood of War and The Badge of Honor, among about 25 others. And we're so happy he's been with us. And just signing in with us now on the line, we see Phil Taubman from New York has just come on with us, and we'll be getting to him in a minute. He wrote a great book called Secret Empire, Eisenhower, the CIA, and the Hidden Story of American Space Espionage. And we're going to be bringing up Eisenhower in just a few minutes. But to continue on, we were talking a little bit about Patton with our good friend here, Carlo Dieste, who wrote all about him. Some people want to know is what schools did Patton go to prior, now that we've talked about his dyslexia? They want to know if he actually did graduate from high schools or colleges, and which ones.
Well, Patton didn't go to school until he was almost 12 years old. His parents understood that there was something wrong as far as his learning ability, so they read to him. His father and his his aunt read to him for over a period of a couple of years. They read him the classics. They read him the Bible. They read him virtually every worthwhile book of history at the time. And what they didn't realize at the time, because he didn't say much, was that he was absorbing each and every one of these. And later on could quote the Bible, virtually any passage at will. So he didn't go to school till he, you know, some of us would have been pretty well through middle school or so. And he had serious academic difficulties as a high schooler. He wanted to go to West Point. His father felt that he would not be able to succeed if he did. So he sent him to VMI for a year. And Patton was quite successful at VMI. He worked extremely hard. And one of the great achievements of his life was actually to pass a competitive examination for a senatorial appointment to West Point from California. And he came out tops, which it was basically nothing more than he slaved for month after month after month preparing himself for this thing. So he had a year at VMI, then he, in 1904, he enrolled at the Military Academy. Flunked out at the end of the year in 1905, came back and said, "By golly, I'm going to stick with this thing. You know, somehow I'm going to get through this." And he did. But it was a tough road for him to graduate. By contrast, Dwight Eisenhower had it fairly easy, pretty much sailed through West Point and just had a grand time while he was there. It was the total opposite of Patton. You know, Patton was all business, worked very hard, was serious, rarely smiled. Ike was the original prankster when he came to West Point in 1911.
never really took it seriously. Could have been kicked out on a number of occasions for his pranks, for violating academy rules, whether it was smoking boxing in the rooms while other things were going on that wasn't supposed to be happening, or leaving post without authority, or dumping buckets of water on his fellow cadets. You know, Ike had a grand time at West Point. But it was only after he left and was commissioned that he began to take life and the Army in particular somewhat seriously. But he was not a serious cadet. So they were total opposites when it came to what they did at West Point.
And then they became friends later in life.
They became probably. Friends later after World War One. Both were members of the new fledgling tank corps. Patton led, raised, and trained the first tank corps, the first tank force that was ever created in the U.S. Army in the American Expeditionary Force under Pershing. Led them into combat at Somme-Hill, and later was wounded and almost died in the Meuse-Argonne on the first day. So his record of accomplishment as a young officer was simply astounding. I mean, people know him for his World War II accomplishments, but in many respects, I rate Patton's World War I achievements on the same level. What he did from nothing was simply incredible. We didn't have any tanks, we didn't have any doctrine, we had nothing. And he created this from scratch.
Not only that, but Patton had the unique experience of a tank that couldn't see. And so, in fact, in many of the battles, he actually had to dismount from his and walk in front of the tanks, leading them along as an infantryman would, and occasionally would walk back and with the butt of his handgun slam the tank and get someone to look at him and then direct their fire, all the while the Germans were shooting at him with machine guns. At one point, he got out so far in front of his lines that he was threatened with relief and had to go beg for his job as well.
Yes, that's true. He did.
No doubt you read Genius at War, Tom.
I'm busy studying how to be a genius at peace, actually. But in order to do that, I guess somebody has to study war.
And starting with Ike then, too, as you were talking about, we have a chat room question that just came in about what did Ike do prior to West Point?
Well, Ike grew up, as most people know, he grew up poor, one of six brothers in Abilene, Kansas. No money in the family. The only way he was going to get a free education was to either get a scholarship or get into one of the military academies. He originally wanted to go to the Naval Academy, was actually admitted, won the competition to go there, but then he was too old. You couldn't be over 19 when you entered, so he also had an appointment to West Point, and he took it. And the only reason he took it was he wanted a free education. At that point, he had no particular desire to become a professional Army officer. It was only later, that after he graduated, that he realized that this was something that he wanted to do with his life. But as I mentioned earlier, he had a grand time while he was at West Point.
Mm-hmm. And in West Point, he flew right through as opposed to Patton, who had his struggles.
He did. And he didn't have particular problems with academics. He really didn't put himself out. I mean, he eventually finished about in the middle of his class. My suspicion is that had he chosen to, he could have finished probably in the top 10. Later on, he was number one in his class at the what is now the Command and General Staff College at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. So he showed later what he could do when he put his mind to it. West Point, there was some a level of immaturity to Eisenhower. That later on, you know, he conquered it. But at that particular point, he was enjoying himself. And he was known as one of the most popular cadets at the military academy. And whenever there were fun and games going on or pranks being committed, you were bound to find Ike at the center of them, almost invariably. So he had a good time, and he didn't take it seriously, whereas, as I mentioned, Patton took it extremely seriously. As early as his days in West Point, you know, Patton envisioned himself as a future general.
Carlo, do you think that there was something about Ike and his personality and his approach to challenges that he was sort of an underachiever?
He was definitely an underachiever. He was known as an underachiever. In fact, many people thought that
that Patton would amount to, would become famous, would probably be a general, and that Ike would be, probably would never amount to much of anything. There were very low expectations when it came to Ike, and this was part of his act. He was deliberately low-key. He used that Kansas grin that became so famous, and I would submit was one of the most famous smiles in American history. And he used that to his advantage. This was his ticket to protecting his character and what was underneath him. He was a very private man. He very rarely let out what his true feelings were. I think we're going to hear a little later in the program some of the things that he actually did say on those one of those rare occasions when he basically let his emotions hang out.
It worked with most people, but maybe not with MacArthur or Marshall.
No, it didn't. And he worked for both of those gentlemen at various points in his career.
There was a famous comment by MacArthur when he was running for president that when they asked him, had he ever worked with Eisenhower, he said, yeah, I had him as a clerk one time, or I remember him working as a clerk for me. And actually, he'd been his aide, I think.
Well, he was basically his assistant, his clerk, his aide. Ike did it all for virtually most of the 1930s, first in the War Department when MacArthur was chief of staff of the Army. And then later on, after he finished and basically Roosevelt let him go and pretty much exiled him to the Philippines, Ike went with him at MacArthur's request. And I liken it to slavery. He slaved for MacArthur for a period of years to the point where it impinged his health. And eventually he realized that two things. One, that World War II was coming and that he needed to get away from MacArthur. And so that occurred in 1939. And the thing he said is there's a war coming. He said, I'm a soldier and I'm going to be in it and I'm going home. And he did.
Interestingly enough, in that 52 election when he was running as well, someone asked Eisenhower if he worked for MacArthur, and he said, yes, I studied acting under him at one point.
They had a very interesting and contentious relationship. Eisenhower was the only officer that ever got away with literally having screaming arguments with Douglas MacArthur. And they went at it, and MacArthur let him get away with it because he realized what a valuable property he had in Ike.
Mr. Griffin, we'd like to ask you for some personal observations of the styles of the two men when we come back.
And we will be back with our guest, Carlo D'Este and W.E.B. Griffin, and we'll be bringing on Phil Taubman. He's an editor with the New York Times who's written a great book about that secret empire. After these messages, we'll be right back.
Stay tuned. The Veterans Radio Show will continue on the Veterans Radio Network.
You're listening to the Veterans Radio Hour. We're heard every Sunday evening between 8 and 10 p.m. Central Standard Time. It's a two-hour program. We'll be finishing our first hour shortly here, and we invite you to stay with us for the entire show. It's really quite an interesting show tonight, and some fascinating conversation taking place. I was particularly intrigued with a comment made about the fact that General Eisenhower was known as a prankster while in West Point, and that he would engage in boxing matches and dump buckets of water on fellow cadets and so on. It's a little bit of a different image than we popularly think of General Eisenhower. As we broke a few minutes ago for the commercial, the guests were just getting into a discussion about the relationship between Eisenhower and MacArthur, which was starting to bring out some other fascinating facts. And indeed, that is what you'll hear each week here on the Veterans Radio Hour. You'll hear very interesting information, not only of historical interest, but information dealing with contemporary topics. The Veterans Radio Hour is a unique theme-based talk show by, for, and about veterans. It's hosted each week by retired Brigadier General Dave Grange. General Dave is away this week on duty with CNN. There's a possibility he's going to be joining us here a little later in the show if he can make it over to Veterans Center Studios. So we're hoping to see General Dave later if possible. Each week here, you'll hear a lively and informative roundtable discussion featuring distinguished military and civilian guests, such as the gentleman we have with us this evening. Topics include everything from historical events to contemporary issues of interest to veterans and active service personnel. If you are a veteran, if you know a veteran, if you care about veterans affairs, the Veterans Radio Hour is a show for you. Stay with us.
Welcome back. The Veterans Radio Show now continues on the Veterans Radio Network.
Yeah, here we are, the Veterans Radio Hour. We're live. General Dave couldn't be with us right now. We're hoping he's going to make it in during our second hour after he finishes up with some of his CNN work. We're talking about generals as leaders with Carlo Dieste, who wrote his books on Patton and Eisenhower. And also I want to bring in for a moment Philip Talman, who is an associate editor of the editorial pages at the New York Times, and has just written a great book. I think it's only been on the market now for about a month, from Simon & Schuster, Secret Empire, Eisenhower, the CIA, and the Hidden Story of America's Spy Espionage. Philip, you there with us?
I am.
Well, thank you for joining us so much. Your book is taking off real big, I hear.
It's doing very well, thank you.
Yeah, I got to see you on C-SPAN. That's where I first started learning about it. Looking at some of the press on it, it's quite a unique book, everything from the Gary Powers that most of us older people remember, the shoot down there in Russia, to just the secret stuff that nobody even knew was happening. How did you decide to start writing about Eisenhower and this period of time?
Well, when I started covering intelligence agencies for the New York Times back in the early 1980s, it seemed like everything I was writing about came from information gathered by either spy satellites or spy planes, and that's what got me interested. And then in 1995, there was a declassification of all the materials associated with the first nation's first spy satellite program, Corona, which went into operation in 1960. That's when I really started in work in earnest and discovered, I think in doing my research and in the book, you'll see a pretty different picture or portrait of Eisenhower and his presidency than I was familiar with, and I think many Americans.
Mm-hmm. And how long were you in Moscow yourself as a reporter?
I worked there for the New York Times for 3.5 years at the first half of Mikhail Gorbachev's tenure as Soviet leader.
Uh-huh. And that's during the glasnost or perestroika, or was that just afterwards?
No, that's when it started. I got there in 1985, just a few months after he had taken office, and was there to witness the beginning of the breakup of the Soviet glacier.
Uh-huh. And in relationship, were you able to then have access to more information than most people because of Gorbachev?
The conditions for foreign journalists changed considerably while I was there. It went from a society in which foreign journalists basically had access to no information firsthand to one in which the government was beginning to become more transparent. It was a far cry from what I had been familiar with trying to write about the American government in Washington, where so much information is available. But over the course of the 3.5 years I was in Moscow, we began to understand a little bit more about the way the Soviet government operated.
Well, I don't want to put you on the spot, but I'm pretty sure that Mr. Griffin and Mr. Dieste are going to read your book. I'm wondering if you happen to read Carlo's book on Eisenhower, A Soldier's Life.
I've been looking at it. It's a wonderful book, and it gives a perspective on Eisenhower during an earlier part of his career. My book focuses on his presidency.
Yes, Carlo's specifically the World War II era and before that, where you seem to come in during Eisenhower's presidency. Is any of your book in the beginning having to do with his years as he was fading out from being a general to becoming a politician?
Basically picks up the story as Eisenhower was leaving military service during the period that he was president of Columbia University, and focuses on his leadership, his really quite visionary, extraordinary leadership in the area of new espionage and military technologies during his presidency, a period in which there was a explosive breakthroughs in engineering and science that produced the U-2 spy plane, the Corona satellite system, the SR-71 Blackbird, not to mention nuclear-powered submarines, aircraft carriers, intercontinental ballistic missiles, and so on. And what I discovered in my research was that during this period, basically from 1954 to 1960, the heart of the Eisenhower presidency, there was an extraordinary collaborative partnership between government, industry, and science that produced these new technologies that really stabilized the Cold War and I think helped to prevent an outbreak of a new war during that period.
And was Eisenhower the think tank behind this or the catalyst?
Eisenhower was the catalyst, and what I found in my research was that obviously he came to office, as your other guests know better than I, with a great regard for military technology, having been a wartime leader and benefited from the invention of radar, the cracking of the German codes, and so on, and the development of the atomic bomb. But unlike many presidents before and since, he put science at a seat in the White House. He brought in Jim Killian, who was the president of MIT, and Edwin Land, whom many of your listeners probably know as the creator of instant photography and founder of the Polaroid Corporation. And with their help and advice, Eisenhower was able to identify some of these unconventional spy technologies that the Air Force was lukewarm about at the time. The Air Force understandably wanted to build bombers and fighter planes. And Eisenhower took these programs, the U-2, the SR-71 Blackbird, and the Corona spy satellite, turned them over, interestingly enough, to the CIA to manage, and brought in companies like Lockheed, General Electric, Kodak, and others, and they worked together in a really quite remarkably cooperative fashion to produce these new systems.
Excellent. We are going to be back for a whole hour, if you can stick with us there, Phil.
Sure.
Bill Griffin down in Argentina with us, Carlo Diestre sitting here with us, along with James Pritzker, Dr. John Votaw from the Cantini Foundation. Right now we're going to break away for our station breaks, and we're going to go out with Tom and a little bit of God Bless the USA.
If tomorrow all the things were gone, I'd work for all my life, and I had to start again with just my children and my wife. I'd thank my lucky star to be living here today, 'cause the flag still stands for freedom and they can't take that away. And I'm proud to be an American, where at least I know I'm free, and I won't forget the men who died, who gave that right to me. And I'd gladly stand up next to you and defend her still today, 'cause there ain't no doubt I love this land. God bless the USA. From the lakes of Minnesota to the hills of Tennessee, across the plains of Texas, from sea to shining sea, from Detroit down to Houston and New York to LA, well, there's pride in every American heart, and it's time we stand and say, hey. And I'm proud to be an American, where at least I know I'm free. And I won't forget the men who died, who gave that right to me. And I gladly stand up next to you and defend her still today, 'cause there ain't no doubt I love this land. God bless the USA. And I'm proud to be an American, where at least I know I'm free. And I won't forget the men who died, who gave.
Stay tuned. The Veterans Radio Show will continue on the Veterans Radio Network.
Well, I hear that train a-coming, rolling around the bend. And I ain't seen my hometown since I don't know when. But I'm locked in Folsom Prison, and time keeps dragging on. But that train keeps rolling on down to San Antone. When I was just a baby, my mama told me, son, always be a good boy and don't ever play with guns. But I rocked a man in Reno just to watch him die. When I hear that whistle blowing, I hang my head and cry. Well, I bet there's rich folks sitting in that fancy dining car. They're probably drinking coffee and smoking big cigars. But I know I had it coming, I know I can't be free. But those people keep a moving, and that's what tortures me. If they freed me from this prison, if that railroad train were mine, I'd probably move it on a little farther down the line. Oh, far from Folsom Prison, that's where I'd like to stay. And I'd let that lonesome whistle blow my blues away.